Hey there, it's Rachel Mullins, the host of Hashtag No Filter Fridays on Public House Media.
Strike three, you're out.
Welcome back to Caught Listening. Broadcasting is part of the Public House Media Network, the baseball podcast that goes beyond the white lines. Chris Scheimler here with you. As we are every single week, you can find us on Apple and Google Podcasts, Spreaker.com, Stitcher.com, iHeartRadio, and now on Amazon Podcasts as well. Don't forget to subscribe, rate, review, share us with your friends and family, and also be a part of the show by submitting show suggestions or questions, whatever you may have, on social media, Twitter, Instagram, Facebook. Just search Caught Listening by Public House Media or email the show, CaughtListeningPHM@gmail.com. World Series is in the books, and we are into the offseason, but that doesn't mean we can stop talking about the World Series, just not this World Series. For those of you tuned in last week, we teased it a little bit, but hard to believe the 20th anniversary of the Subway Series, the Mets and the Yankees, in which the Yankees really cemented their dynasty legacy at that point in time. And for those of you Mets fans, you know, obviously another in the long line of disappointments, despite such a great season for the Mets. And what was really kind of fun at the start of this year, a friend of mine, I noticed he put out there that he was written a book about it, the 20th anniversary of the Subway Series, and figure what better time to bring him on than just after the Fall Classic. He is Jerry Beach, author of the Subway Cities Baseball's Big Apple Battles and the Yankees Mets 2000 World Series. Jerry, how are you, pal?
Hey, Christian. Thanks for having me on, buddy. I appreciate it. All is going well. I hope you're doing well in the midst of all this craziness.
it definitely is, but I enjoyed reading your book because it you know, there's so much about it. First of all, before we get to the way it's written and whatnot, what got you into writing this book?
Well, that's one of my favorite, most amusing stories. You know, if you're as a writer, you know, I've written a couple of books, and you always have book ideas, and you pitch them, and they just don't land, and that's okay. You know, it's a hard industry, and people want something that's gonna, you know, pretty broad, and it doesn't sell. It's nothing personal, and that's okay. This one just came to me. Sports Publishing approached a friend of mine, Brian Hoke from Yankees.com, and they'd had a hole in their schedule. Someone was supposed to do this book, and couldn't for spring of 2020. For at least the spring of 2020. Mm-hmm. And so they asked him, do you know anybody who might be able to put this together pretty quickly? And this was in June of 19. And the deadline was mid-November of 19. So do you know anyone who can write this book from start to finish in 5 months? And Brian, thankfully, said he knew me, put me in touch with them, and that got the ball rolling. But it's just funny how, like, in this business, you can get rejected 10, yeah, 20, 30 times, and then something happens and you weren't even looking for it.
Yeah, out of
and
nowhere.
And it worked out really well for me because I'd covered the World Series in 2000. And as I like to say, you know, all my hoarding and keeping stuff worked out because I had all this stuff in the basement, newspaper clips, stories I'd written. I had floppy disks. Remember floppy disks? I had some of those downstairs. And I have a floppy disk reader. So, like, you know, it was like, you know, somebody said, you know, can you write a book on the 1980s Celtics Lakers rivalry in 4 months? No, I can't do that.
Right.
But, you know, there's three things I could write about in 4 months: this World Series, something to do with the Simpsons, and of course, Hofstra Hoops.
And of course, Hofstra Hoops, of course, 100%.
Of course. And this is the broadest one. So, so like I said, mid June of 19, I remember very well the first interviews I did were at Old Timers Day at Yankee Stadium. And then there's some quotes in the book that I got that day from Louis Soho and Jeff Nelson. And I was very fortunate. You know, I'm in New York, obviously, and that summer, back when, you know, things were nice and normal, the Mets would have alumni in every homestand, and most of them were from that 2000 team. Mm-hmm. So I just talked to them at the ballpark, and then the Yankees, you know, their legends are in their broadcast booth.
Right.
So O'Neill, Cone, you know, it was pretty easy to get those guys too. So I was very fortunate, and you know, I was able to get to both parks pretty easily and, you know, fill in any holes I might have had by talking to guys who were readily accessible. I got Joe Torre in a dugout. He was doing his safe at home, talking about safe at home. I got him at the City Field dugout, in mid-September of 2019. So it was just, you know, it came together. Like I said, you know, you'll put together proposals for books and they kind of perish on the vine. And then this one just, can you do this? And if you can do it, great. We need it by such a date. So, all right, I can do that. And, you know, I really enjoyed covering it in real time. It was a blast to revisit again. So it was a pretty easy decision to say yes to it.
Yeah. And again, it's because, you know, it's one of those series that it gets a lot of fond memories simply because it's the Yankees and the Mets. And it's the first mm-hmm. time that has happened in like five decades, whatever it was.
Yep.
Overall, the game, you know, the series wasn't that there were all very close games, and they probably could have gone either way, but you almost felt, especially, and you detail this in the book, especially in game four, that it was over when the first pitch is thrown in game
right.
four. Derek Jeter's leadoff home run off of Bobby Jones. But
right.
what about this series captivated so many people to the point where it bears going back to 20 years later?
Well, it's like, I think the end quote in the book was Bobby Valentine saying, we never had Cubs White Sox, mm-hmm. never had Angels Dodgers. I mean, we got Yankees Mets, and it's freaking cool. And I think also, like, you know, let's just say for argument's sake, you know, the Yankees and Mets played in 2000, and then they played again in 2001, and 2004, and 2000, whatever. If they played four or five times in the World Series since then, I think 2000 wouldn't be as noticeable. Mm-hmm. But it was the first time in 44 years. And I think at the time, certainly, you know, biased up here in New York, we thought, okay, you know, this is, if not a sign of things to come, you know, it'll happen again at some point in the next few years. And it never did. You know, 2006 was our best chance.
Right.
The Yankees got knocked out in the first round. Mets, you know, on the Carlos Beltran caught looking. So I think the fact that it was the first time in 44 years, the first time since, you know, because, you know, if you're our age, you know, you always read about the Subway Series every
right.
year, Yankees, Dodgers, Yankees, Giants. Happened all the time, center of the universe. And then baseball expanded, and, you know, there are more teams to get to fight through to get to the World Series. And then they had the divisions, the LCS play. Then they had the wild card. Then nowadays, now you have, this year we had 16 teams. But I think going forward, I think we'll have more than two wild cards. So it's not just enough just to be the best team in your league, like the Dodgers / Giants and Yankees were in the 30s and 40s and 50s.
Right.
Now you got to be the best team in your league and survive three or four playoff rounds. So it was a really cool, everything was aligned sort of way. And we've learned in the last 20 years how rare that was, how hard it was for that to happen, to get the matchup, this particular matchup. And even this year, it's Tampa Bay. It was Tampa Bay versus Los Angeles.
Right.
It's, I think it was only the fourth or fifth time since the wild card era that the top two seeds, the two teams with the best records in each league, made the World Series.
Yeah.
There's so much random stuff that can happen. It's not March Madness, but it's close enough.
Right.
So I think, you know, you can throw all that in there, and now it's 66 years, 64 years since the last, we had one Subway Series in 64 years. It's really cool. And I think that sticks with people, and it's a cool thing that if you were around, you got to experience. And if you weren't, if you're not old enough to remember that, you want to, and you're a big baseball fan in New York, you want to see it again. And then I think also the fact that it was just, you know, every game had something that you remembered. All, you know, a certain, right. you only have to say a couple words, you know, game one, Timo.
Yep.
Game two, Clemens Piazza. Game three was kind of routine. The Mets won it, but the Mets won it. And it's the
right.
only game they won. So you remember that. Game four, as you said, Jeter homers leading off. Game five, Soho's 1,000 bouncer up the middle. So every game, even though it was a five-game series, as you said, could have gone either way. And it's fun to look back on it and say, what if the Mets hang on in game one? What if Benitez strikes out Paul O'Neill and gets a third out and they go up 1-0 and Clemens, you know, he pitched better from ahead than behind in the playoffs.
Mm-hmm.
What if they're down 0-1? You know, what happens then? You know, he was revved up and crazy for game two of the 1-0 lead. What happens if they're trying to avoid falling behind 2-0 going back to Queens?
Right.
So, you know, even though it was a quick series, and it was quick, it was 6 days or five
yeah.
days. It was so much, you know, to be parsed and to be, you know, looked back upon and second guessed and stuff like that, that it just, you know, it still lingers the people who saw it and watched it and enjoyed New York baseball as a really cool thing that happened that, like Bobby B said, it hasn't happened in L.A. It hasn't happened in
right.
Chicago. It's just happened here. And it's just so rare and unique, and it's cool to look back on it.
And that's what part of it is. And I mean, you know, not being a native New Yorker, and I think a lot of people have this anti-New York bias when you know, Yankees and Mets all get together, you know, all against the, you know, when the Knicks were good a quarter century ago, when the Giants, you know, there's this anti-New York sentiment. And so you look at it, and it's the majority of people, because you even detail that in the book, that, like, outside of New York, maybe it wasn't the biggest story, but in the media mecca of the world, with the most recognizable franchise in the world and their little brother playing, who's just fighting for relevancy after, you know, 20 years, almost 20 years of what the Mets were after 86, it just felt like that was it really, even though it's two teams in the same city, it felt like the world was watching it to the people within that realm. We're talking with Jerry Beach, author of the Subway Series, Subway Series, Baseball's Big Apple Battles and the Yankees-Mets 2000 World Series. The thing I love about this book is, honestly, just how much detail you put into the history of New York City baseball. And again, not being a New Yorker native, but understanding and learning more about the history of the Giants, the Dodgers, what the Yankees were throughout the periods of time, when the Mets came around, the 70s for the Yankees, everything, the Mayor's Trophy, which I had completely forgotten about until reading. But then also, just again, it sparked into my mind, and I brought this up last week on the show that I don't think people realize, but, like, again, I almost forgot that if Steinbrenner hadn't been suspended, Derek Jeter may never have made the Yankees big club. You go into the detail, the history of New York City baseball. How much fun was that for you as a baseball guy to look back over the century plus of baseball played in New York City?
That was a lot of fun. And, like, you know, it's funny because the publisher kind of gave me a rough outline that they kind of put together, and they wanted, you know, the history of you know, Subway Series ball in New York, and which I did too. And I kind of looked at it, and originally had it kind of just starting as like an encyclopedia from, you know, early 1900s to 2000. But, you know, I was fortunate to have some pretty good first person recollections and quotes and interviews about the World Series. I didn't want to, like, you know, have the first two chapters be like, you know, dry recitation of, you know, stuff from books and other sources. So my idea was to kind of, like you saw, intersperse it. So game one, what was about, you know, I made Yogi the hook because Yogi had coached, managed, or played in, I can't remember the top number off the top of my head, but every New York World Series, every New York team in a World Series, Yogi had been involved from, like, the 40s until the Yankees' last title in their dynasty in the 70s. And even in 86, you can make a case he was involved because he was a coach of the Astros,
right?
Which is just a hilarious picture if no one's ever seen it. Google Yogi Berra Astros. Yogi in those rainbow unis is hilarious. But, so, yeah, I wanted to kind of, you know, mention the history in a kind of a way to kind of bring it together with the current time, as opposed to kind of being dry. And you know, game three was a perfect spot to kind of mention the Mets, you know, rough beginnings and you know, their decades long pursuit of the Yankees and just how differently they were built and how different the fan bases are. But yeah, it was a lot of fun. And, you know, like I said, the book kind of came together quickly. So I bought a handful of, you know, New York baseball history books. And we had long planned, long before this book came, long before I got the book, we planned a trip to Disney in August of 2019. And I had to be the only guy in Disney carrying around Roger Clemens biographies and Roger Kahn books about the Brooklyn Dodgers, as, you know, because I'd read it on the shuttles, and then we'd get back to the room at night, and I'd read for a while. But, you know, as you know, baseball guy, you know this stuff. It's in your base. You know it. You know of it. But it's really great to read more about it, and to, like, you know, I read, you know, it's in the book, kind of like the similarities between Casey Stengel and Joe Torre. You know, they were both they weren't losers. I'm not saying they were losers, but the rep was, you know, they couldn't get a team over the top. You know, they were pretty good managers, pretty good players. Joe's a better player, but they weren't, you know, they managers. And then they're in their, you know, they're getting older, 50s, 60s. They get one shot at the Yankees, and they turn them into dynasties. And every move they make works. You know, Roger Kahn called Casey Stengel's, you know, luck black magic-like.
Right.
You know, Joe's, everything Joe did worked out.
Yep.
You know, he
for a guy who was 100 games under 500 as a manager when he was hired.
Right, right. And he'd said it, you know, I thought I was done because he'd managed three teams he'd worked for, the Braves, Mets, and Cardinals. He's not a team that he'd worked for.
Right.
And so, you know, he's 56, 96, he's 55, and 56, he got hired. It's like, all right, you know, I'm home. You know, I'm paraphrasing. But, you know, the worst, if it doesn't work out, you know, what's the risk? Mm. And instead it worked out, and, you know, he's a Hall of Famer, and as you said in the book, you know, it's everything he's done, you know, is thanks to stint with the Yankees.
Right.
So it's just fascinating to look at the similarities between the managers, and it's fascinating to kind of track the, you know, how the Mets of 2000 were a really good team, obviously they made the World Series, but how they were kind of like a ragtag bunch in terms of, you know, Piazza, 62nd round draft pick.
Right.
Robert Ventura had a really bad ankle injury that some thought might end his career in 97. Todd Zeal, a really good player, played for about 1,000 teams. Just, you know, Benny Agbayani was a, you know, 30th round draft pick out of a Division II school in Hawaii.
Right.
All these kind of like different pieces came together, not misplaced parts, but, you know, they were just guys who, you know, had all kind of struggled to get to where they were and could enjoy where they got to. And Met fans can appreciate that because, you know, it's not a linear path for the Mets.
Right.
And then the Yankees, you know, Jeter, like you said, you know, if Steinbrenner doesn't get suspended or banned, you know, who knows what happens. But those few years gave Gene Stickmichael a chance to kind of say, okay, let's just kind of rebuild this back up and you know, flush out some of the guys you don't think can win with us and build a culture. And he traded for Paul O'Neill, who's, you know, was just, you know, the linchpin of that team. And,
yeah,
you know, they got Tino Martinez after 95 season. And so, and then by the time they won in 96, you know, there was enough evidence that it was working. Mm-hmm. So that I'm sure George had his moments, and you saw in the book, you know, he was, you know, at his rabid best in the World Series in 2000, because you can't lose to the Mets.
Right.
But, you know, he'd been gone just long enough, and they had succeeded by other people, you know, Cashman and Watson and Torrey doing their jobs. Said, okay, let's leave it alone. And, you know, now the Yankees are probably maybe the most stable team in sports, or at least in baseball.
Yeah.
I mean, Cashman's been GM for 20 odd years. They've had what? Torrey, three managers since 95.
Torrey, Girardi, Boone. Yeah. Since 95. Yeah. I mean, and you know, it's what's great. One of the things that I love, you know, again, the thing I love about reading the history and learning the history of the game is that we are in such the information age right now. The social media age of gimme, right now, right now, right now, this is what I need. We forget the history of the game, or we refuse to learn it. And I always love going back and looking at the history of baseball, because there are moments, there are relationships. Baseball is such a small world. And 162 minor league affiliates, 30 major league teams, you know, X number of independent clubs, you know, college, all that stuff. But baseball is still such a small world. And I don't think, without reading this book, I would have really remembered the relationship and the path crossed, the entanglement of Joe Torrey and Bobby Valentine, the managers in this World Series.
Yeah. Like, I, you know, again, you know, you knew about it a little bit. You know, I being around, being in the New York area my whole life, you kind of knew, you know, vague things read about it.
Mm-hmm.
But, like, yeah, like, down to, like, Joe and Bobby playing in Joe's last game.
Right.
You know, Joe, I don't like Bobby pitched for him, but I know Bobby played in his last game. But, like, yeah, Joe and Bobby were, you know, teammates.
Right.
Joe was his manager. And Joe was the guy who said, I'm not sure you can play anymore. And Bobby didn't like that. And then he realized, you know, he's probably right. I'm probably pretty beat up. And, yeah, and just, you know, and that's in the late 70s. And then 20-odd years later, you know, their paths crossed again.
Right.
And it's kind of like, and like at that time, and I think in the 70s and early 80s, they were probably in the same boat. Like, you know, Joe was a much better player. But managerial-wise, he just couldn't get over that hump. Mm-hmm. And he had some, you know, not so great teams. And he was just another guy, in Bill Parcells' term, a jag.
Right.
Then he gets to New York across town, and now he's the Hall of Famer. And Bobby's still that scrappy. You know, I'm going to try and put together this potluck supper, guys, and try to beat your brains in. And like Todd Zeal had said, you know, you could tell that Bobby, when he managed against a Leland, or a Torrey or a Cox or a La Russa, you know, really got revved up because those were the guys he thought, and I think he was right. He was as good as those guys, but didn't get, you know, his teams were just a little bit short and they were kind of overlooked. And he wanted to prove that he was as good as those guys and his players were as good as those guys, as those teams. Whereas, you know, and Torrey would have been in that same boat, you know, 20 years earlier. Imagine the Mets, imagine the Braves, imagine the Cardinals. The Braves had that one great year where they won 13 in a row to start the year, won the division, and then kind of petered out. You know, and he was that guy, you know, kind of like trying to take on, you know, take on the establishment. And then all of a sudden, you know, the Yankees win 96, and then 98 is, you know, the greatest team maybe of all time. Mm-hmm. And you can't get any more establishment now than Joe Torrey and the Yankees.
Right.
And here comes Bobby V, still the underdog, still the kind of like to stir things up, you know, kind of like tweak the establishment guy coming in with his team. And it's just fascinating. And again, like you said, you remember they were kind of connected through their end of their playing days, but you forgot just how similar those paths were. And then how, when, you know, they veered off when Bobby became, when Joe became manager of the Yankees, makes it even more fascinating that now, you know, there's like a double layer of what Bobby's trying to accomplish, knocking off a former peer.
Right.
And again, and then Joe, of course, is a Queens guy, a New York guy, a Manhattan guy. So another thing, like you said, nothing like being carried off the field in your hometown to win a
right.
championship.
Exactly.
And that's what he did, you know?
We're talking with Jerry Beach, author of the book, The Subway Series, Baseball's Big Apple Battles, and the Yankees-Mets 2000 World Series, 20th anniversary of that World Series in which the Yankees defeated the Mets 4-1. Despite all five games being very close and very exciting as well, that series, the 2000 series, is the one that kind of really, truly, fully cemented the legacy of the core four in Jeter, Posada, yep. Pettit, Mariano, you know, Bernie involved in there, the fifth Beatle.
Yeah, poor Bernie. I never got that. Bernie was there, drafted, you know, I think signed in the 80s.
Yeah.
And, like, you know, he played center field. It was like he was a DH or a left field. He played center field.
He
you
played
know,
center
was,
field.
For the Posada, yeah. Pettit, Jeter, Bernie. The lack of love for Bernie has always kind of boggled my mind. He doesn't seem to mind. He's kind of amused by it all, too, I think. But
yeah.
Anyway, yeah, you're right. So the core four plus one.
But the thing that is so amazing to me is I look at it, and again, reading this book was a great way to relearn the history of it. I almost wonder if in today's day and age, the core four cemented their legacy, yes, 100%, but the way that 2000 Mets team was put together by Steve Phillips mm-hmm. and his group, and the way the rocky, at best, relationship between Steve Phillips and Bobby Valentine to put that team together in today's social media era, I don't know if the Mets make it out of the All-Star break.
Yeah. It's funny because this was 20 years ago this spring where Wartengate happened, where Bobby yep. V got in trouble in hot water. He made a speech on an off day at University of Penn's business school.
Right.
And afterwards, some fans came up to him and started asking questions. And Bobby just, God bless him, doesn't have a filter. Can't say no to anything.
Right.
And so he said, you know, he would have preferred they not sign Derek or acquire Derek Bell because he wanted to play Agbayani.
Right.
Why'd you sign Ray Ordonez? Because he can't hit. I'm paraphrasing. But,
yeah.
And, you know, he made some pretty bold statements and, you know, end up dodging getting fired then because, A, it was 2000 and there's no Twitter. And this
right.
kid, a guy named Brad, posted on the Mets message board, which is crazy. You think about now.
Those pesky message boards.
Bobby, Steve, what's that?
Those pesky message boards.
Those pesky message boards, yeah. How innocent those days now seem.
Yep.
And Steve had said, you know, if I found out you said this in a speech, you're fired. Bobby said, okay, I didn't say it in a speech. Now, he did not say it, but he said right. it in passing to some kid he just thought he was shooting the breeze with.
Right.
But, yeah, and that was a big deal in 2000. I remember that very, very well. And you really thought for a couple of days, this Bobby might not survive this.
Mm-hmm.
And then they were winning, and so they kind of hung on. And as also, you know, he was in his last year of his contract, so was Steve. I'm not sure that management ownership wanted to move on at that point. But in 2020, if that happened, oh, man, you know, I mean, you know, Steve is an old fashioned guy, and he said he liked to talk to the press every day because, you know, that was the conduit to the public and helps sell papers and helps sell your team. Nowadays, you know, teams don't feel the need to do that. But let's just say for argument's sake that Steve talked every day and Bobby talked every day. It'd be every day of, you know, Bobby would talk at 4:00 and then you go to Steve and Bobby said this and then you go back to try to get Bobby. Steve said this, and I'm not sure if they could have lasted. Not that they lasted long, if you think about it. They lasted just parts of five seasons, right? Yeah, Bob, Steve took over 97, and Bobby was fired at the end of 02. So they were together for five-plus, you know, tumultuous seasons. And both said, you know, they wished it had worked out better. You know, Steve, you know, had lost his job briefly. He took a leave of absence after news of an affair within the office leaked out. And he came back, was kind of, you know, kind of closed himself off. And Bobby thought that Steve thought that Bobby wanted his job because Bobby was one of the temporary GMs or part of the ownership, part of the GM group when right. Steve was on leave. And so, you know, it was poor communication on both sides. It could have been handled better by both sides. And look what they did not getting along.
Right.
They made the World Playoffs 99. Should have almost made the World Series 99. You know, almost making that first baseball team to come back from 0-3 in a best of seven. And I think if they win game six, they win game seven. And then that would have been a great Subway Series because you would have the Yankees at their absolute peak. And the Mets, I think, that was their best team since A6. And then they make the World Series in 2000, obviously. And then 2001, they have a great run right, you know, before and after the terrorist attacks that got them back in the swing of things. So, you know, it was a good run, but I think they both were a little bit melancholy. That it could have been a little bit better. And yeah, in 2020, you know, in the 2010s and early 20s, I'm not sure how if they could have lasted 5 years. But, you know, they were at the forefront of the manager and GM maybe not always getting along.
Right.
Because, you know, back then it was kind of like the manager was ran the show and the GM was in the shadows. And Steve, you know, was peers of Billy Beane. And, you know, Billy was starting that whole, you know, the moneyballization of front offices, where the front office runs the show and is the best known personality. And that's, you know, I see maybe that was some, you know, maybe, you know, Bobby's an old school guy. Steve, you know, was the GM dressed in a suit and tie every single day, even on 95 degree days at shade. Steve would come out in a suit and tie, and it was different. You know, it was, you know, Frank Cashin, the old general manager, the A6 team, was a former sports writer and a horse racing guy, and kind of, you know, he looked like a sports writer. You know, Steve was very slick, very, very, very corporate. He exuded a sort of corporate cool. And now that's what we got. You know, I mean, you know, Steve had a master's in business. And he worked as a motivational speaker before that. And now, you know, baseball world is filled with corporate guys.
Yep.
So in some ways, those two were kind of ahead of the curve. And I'm sure if you took Bobby V and Steve Phillips and dropped them into 2020, I would imagine that they would handle themselves differently than they did in 2000.
Yes,
100%. You know, just because the way the culture is now, and you wouldn't have a GM and a manager openly sniping at each other.
Right. I want to ask you a couple more questions here before I run out of time. But the image that has popped up across when people think the 2000 World Series, at least for me, the number one image that sticks into my head is part of a broken bat being hurled at Mike Piazza. And the surrealness of that moment, and you go into great detail explaining, like even recapping the broadcast moment by moment, word by word of Joe Buck, Bob Brenly, Tim McCarver, just going, what is happening here?
Yeah.
In that moment, if you could try to encapsulate it somewhat quickly, in that moment, because you covered that World Series, what's going through your mind?
What the, you know what? I mean, it's just so weird. And like, what I forgot until I rewatched it was how fast it happened. It was like a minute.
Yeah.
You know, Piazza grounds out or hits the ball. Clemens chucks the bat. Dude, what's your problem? Benches the bullpen's empty. Clemens says he thought it was the ball. And teams get separated and they restart play and he grounds out. And it's like, okay, it happened so fast. And like, you know, there was game two. That I certainly think that how it happened helped the Yankees because it was weird. I think they were already winning. It was top of the first, so they weren't winning. So I think they took the lead at the bottom of the first. You know, and Clemens, you know, he probably should have been thrown out. I mean, he should have been. He threw a bat at a guy. Mm-hmm. And all this happened, you know, I think if, like Turk Wendell said, if it was me and I throw Derek Jeter, I'm out and I'm done. and I think, frankly, anybody else, he probably gets thrown out because it's just such a audacious act, but everybody knew their history.
Right.
And I think, you know, okay, if Clemens beams him in the head, he gets ejected, whatever. But that happening, like Kent Davidoff of the New York Post wrote this week, the Post had a Subway Series insert, and he said, you know, if you could come up with 1,000 things of how Piazza Clemens, their first at-bat since Piazza got beamed, would turn out, that wouldn't be the top 1,000.
Right.
You know, ground out, a fly out, pop out, home run, brawl. You know, beaning, whatever. You know, throwing a broken bat to guy.
Yeah.
No, nobody saw that coming in a million years. So I think that stunned everybody. And then Mike Canton, you know, didn't have the great stuff he had in the LCS. And the Yankees jumped out and cruised until that ninth inning when they scored 5 runs. And Jay Payton became the answer to a trivia question by becoming the last human to homer off Mariano Rivera in the postseason.
Right.
You know, it's such a – and it's funny, like I just said, like it happened so quick, and yet it's going to be talked about forever. I mean, it's – you hate to say it's the defining image of two Hall of Famers. I think Clemens gets in the Hall of Fame, and that's the top of our time. I think Clemens should be a Hall of Famer.
Yeah.
But it's up there. I mean, Piazza's 9/11 home
runs.
Piazza's 9/11
home run, yeah. Yeah. And, you know, I mean, depending on who, you know, what you ask them for Clemens, there's
right.
going to be a lot. There's going to be off-the-field stuff that gets involved in that, too. But
That's true.
You know, last thing I want to ask you here, because, again, that win, like we talked about earlier, cements the legacy of the core four.
Yep.
If the Mets win that World Series, I don't necessarily believe it turns the tide, because there's always that, you know, 2015, Mets fans thought that they were going to take over New York City. Sorry.
Yeah.
No, that's not possible. New York will always and forever be a Yankee town. But if the Mets win that World Series, does it change the trajectory at all of the Mets franchise in the 2000s, and you know, that 2006 team, that 2015 team, I mean, do those things even happen?
It's interesting. That's a really good question. I'm not sure it changes their trajectory, but it does change history, because, you know, there's only been one Subway Series, and yeah, the Mets have generally, you know, stepbrothers for at that point 40 years, now almost 60 years.
Right.
But the one time they played, let's just say the Mets won. If the Mets won that World Series, yeah, okay, you've got your 26 championships. But the one time we played you, kicked your ass, you know.
Yep, exactly.
I mean, and like I'm, you know, 20 years ago I would have said, yeah, you know, that nullifies everything the Yankees did. Now, you know, they won 3 titles in 4 years. Let's just say regular season, they lost to the Mets. I still think they're a dynasty. And 20 years later, we haven't seen a team win 2 in a row. Never mind 3.
Right.
Or never mind 3 out of 4, which the Yankees had done at that point. Now it's 4 out of 5. And really, in a year later, it should have been 5 out of 6. But you know, before the ninth inning. But so, like, if you look at it kind of outside, you know, take a step out, like, hey, they won 3 out of 4, 96, 98, 99. They lost 2000. It's a phenomenal run. You know, it hasn't been matched since then. It's one of the great runs of all time. You know, yeah, they lost 2000, but they weren't a very good team. They lost 15 to 18 to end the year. They had the fewest wins of any playoff team. You know, they'd run out of gas. But if you live in New York, it's a different story.
Yep.
Like the PR guy for the Yankees said, you don't lose to the Mets.
Right.
I started to say, what they want to say to you, what you went through. No, he's actually banging the table. You don't lose to the Mets. And, you know, George was 70. He's 70. He was still, you know, really vibrant. And, you know, a few years later, his health started to decline. So that was still peak George.
Right.
So if you lose that year, it's real possible that, like, not only, you know, that the fans think none of the 3 years, previous years happened, and that they choked, and who knows what happens. You know, I don't think, you know, I should say I don't think, but like 4 years later, you know, they had the big collapse against the Yankees, against the Red Sox, which to me is worse than that.
Yeah.
To me, that's worse than losing to the Mets.
Yep.
If you lose to the Mets in 7, it was a great series. You had the Red Sox 3 outs away from elimination and suffered the worst collapse in sports history.
Right.
No one got fired, but again, George was kind of, you know, he had kind of declined a little bit, so maybe that's not a fair comp. But to go back to your original question, I don't know if it changes that trajectory, just because the Mets were already an older team. Piazza was 32, Ventura was 33, Jay Payton, their rookie, was 28 already. I mean, they were pretty, you know, and you see next year, 2001, they had a pretty terrible year for 4 months and got hot at the end. And in 2002, you know, it collapsed and they finished in last place.
Right.
3 and 4, 3, they were in last place. And, you know, by the time I got back in 6, it was a whole new core of guys.
Right.
But again, now Steve Phillips also said in the book, he thought that the Mets in 2000 were satisfied. They got to the World Series. You know, it was a hard road. They got there. Maybe 2001, they weren't as focused. They weren't as driven.
Right.
Maybe if they win in 2000, maybe all of a sudden then it's okay. We'll go get Alex Rodriguez to build on this. You know, all of a sudden he's not a 24-1 guy. All of a sudden it's we're the defending world champions, and we can get the best shortstop in baseball, the best hitter in baseball, to pair with the best catcher in baseball, and we'll worry about, you know, and so then if you don't sign Mike Hampton, you got Alex Rodriguez, Mike Fetz batting 3-4. He's doing all right.
Yep.
So it's interesting. It's interesting how maybe, you know, I don't think, you know, knowing what we know about the Wilpons, I don't think that would have changed how they pursued that offseason. And if anything, it might be like, hey, we won. We're the best team in New York. Yeah, we don't need A-Rod. But it's also, you know, it's fun to think about the other side of the what if. Like, okay, maybe they are more passionate and more aggressive to stay on top. My guess is, you know, that doesn't change anything. The Mets will still taper off. And look at the Yankees tapered off, too. They probably should have won in 01, but, you know, they didn't get back to the World Series again until 09. Haven't been back there since. So I think both teams, you know, their cores were getting older. And, you know, what the Yankees did was remarkable and draining. They basically played an extra season's worth of playoff games in that run.
Right.
I think that season, that if it, you know, I think that probably win or lose was probably the peak, probably represent the end of the peak for both teams. But sure, it's fun to wonder. You know, I have more fun pondering the what ifs in 2000. You know, how does that change the legacies of those teams? How does it change, you know, how the Mets are viewed in the city? Because if you win that World Series, you've won. Yeah, like I said, you've won 25 World Championships, but the Mets are 1-0 against you in the World Series. And so it would be, you know, fascinating to see how the fan base would react to that. And again, it goes back to the Yankees couldn't lose that no matter what. And the Mets were kind of in a no-lose position, fan base and team. If you lose, yeah, you're the Mets. You know, you're not supposed to win. But if you won, it changed everything. So I think the trajectories would remain the same. I think, maybe it doesn't take 15 years for the Mets to get back, but I don't think that would have changed the long-term, their long-term trajectory. It would have been interesting to see what happens to the Yankees if they lose, if they start breaking it up. But again, those guys, you know, you're not trading Jeter. Paul's 37, going on 38. Tino's in his last year of his contract. You know, it would have been interesting to see how George would respond to Cashman and Torrey, but we look back on it now, and that was the end of that run. You know, they had one more, and they should have won in 01, and that was it. So it's not like, you know, it's not like firing them would have shortened the run. You know what I mean?
Right.
So it's interesting. It sure is fun. And like, you know, Todd Pratt says, you know, I don't know if we win game one, but now you're up 1-0. You've bloodied their nose. You've punched them in the nose the first time. And they've never been down in a series, in a World Series. Since 96, they've been down once. They were down to Cleveland, 2-1 in 98. Other than that, they're always playing from ahead. So, you know, who knows? I'm sorry. They're also trailing Oakland they were never trailing the World Series since 2-0 in Atlanta. So who knows how they react if they're down. And going back to our topic from earlier, you know, if Clemens has to pitch from behind, who knows? So that to me is the most fun part of the what ifs. How do their narratives change in that pocket of window there? If the Mets can somehow win game one and win the series, it would be fascinating to see.
It's a great book on the history of New York City baseball. It's a great look back at the, you know, seismic, you know, meaning of a Subway Series and what it did for two really historic franchises and two pinnacle cornerstone players, of course, and obviously Piazza and Clemens and looking back at that. But it's also got some great pop culture references, which I always know I'm going to get from you. A Boston Public reference was not what I was expecting reading it, but I absolutely loved it.
Yeah.
Jerry,
well, they had the Stars sitting there at the field, game one. Oh, yeah, I looked it up. Oh, yeah, it started Monday night. Great.
Jerry Beach, as always, buddy, it's great talking to you. The Subway Series, baseball's Big Apple Battles, and the Yankees-Mets 2000 World Series. Go out, buy it now. Teach yourself the history of New York City baseball, even if you aren't a New Yorker, because it is some of the best baseball that there is. Jerry, we appreciate it.
Thanks, Christian. Be good, be safe, be healthy, and hopefully get a full baseball season next year.
100%. All right, that's Jerry Beach, author of the Subway Series, Baseball's Big Apple Battles, and the Mets-Yankees 2000 World Series. Like I mentioned, it's a lot of fun to read back and look at the history of that series, what it meant to the sport, what it meant to the country at the time. Obviously not knowing what it meant to the country, what would happen just 11 months later. But it's interesting to look back and see what could have happened and what did happen. And just, I love books like this because they teach you so much about the history of the game that, and some stories that we never would have known if not going back and looking at them. So check it out. Buy it wherever you can. Buy books. Again, Jerry Beach, the Subway Series, Baseball's Big Apple Battles, and the Mets-Yankees 2000 World Series. Really appreciate his time. Really appreciate you guys listening. Don't forget to subscribe, rate, review, share with your friends and family, and find us on social media. Till next week, I'm Christian Heimel. You have been caught listening.
Virginia, William Hill, America's number one sports book, is now here. And we have a special 2021 offer to help you bet on all your favorite sports risk-free. Download the William Hill Sportsbook app, and when you sign up, you can get started with a risk-free bet of up to $2,021. Use promo code RADIORF.
Terms and conditions apply. 21 plus only. Gambling problem? Call, text, or chat our confidential and toll-free helpline at 1-888-532-3500.
Let's make it interesting with William Hill Sportsbook.
April is Parkinson's Awareness Month. Visit michaeljfox.org/April to get involved in the nationwide Parkinson's community. Meet people, share your story, and support research that will make a difference in millions of lives. That's michaeljfox.org/April. The Michael J. Fox Foundation. We're here till Parkinson's isn't.